Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Produced at the Recording Library of West Texas. Your narrator is Jack.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading articles from Cowboys and Indians magazine. Dennis Quaid. An exclusive interview with the actor as he steps into the boots of President Ronald Reagan for a new biopic coming out early next year. By Joe Layden. To begin with the obvious question, why Reagan? Dennis Quaid chuckled in response to the query, then replied with a question of his own. Do you mean the man or the movie? Maybe both. For the benefit of those who tuned in late, Reagan, director Sean McNamara's independently produced biographical film about Ronald Reagan, features Quaid in the title role as the 40th President of the United States. The biopic, due for an early 2023 theatrical release, focuses on the widely admired actor-turned-politician, widely known to friends and admirers as the Gipper, a nickname he earned for playing ill-fated college football star George Gipp in the classic 1940 drama Newt Rockne, All-American. While following him from his Illinois childhood to his Hollywood heyday to his White House presidency. The supporting cast includes Penelope Ann Miller as First Lady Nancy Reagan, Mayna Savary as Jane Wyman, Reagan's first wife, Leslie Ann Down as British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, Kevin Dillon as Warner Brothers Studio Chief Jack Warner, and John Voight as a KGB agent who tracked Reagan for 40 years. And Quaid is the first to admit he was initially reluctant to sign on for the movie. Mind you, he wasn't averse to portraying a real-life person. Throughout an extremely diverse career that has spanned six decades, the Houston-born actor has played such notable figures as outlaw Ed Miller in The Long Riders, astronaut Gordon Cooper in The Right Stuff, rock and roll wild man Jerry Lee Lewis in Great Balls of Fire, Wild West legend Doc Holliday in Wyatt Earp, late-blooming MLB pitcher Jim Morris in The Rookie, Texas founding father Sam Houston in The Alamo, and another president, Bill Clinton, in The Special Relationship. But Ronald Reagan was, well, different. I was reluctant to portray him at first, Quaid said, while calling from his home in Nashville, because he was a hero of mine. He's my favorite president of the 20th century, really. I was encouraged by the fact that we were both actors, and we both have a sunny disposition, but it's one of those things where you get a tingle of fear up your spine about doing. But you know what? Whenever I get that, that's usually an indication that I should do something. So that's why I did it. It was quite a journey. Really an amazing experience. And Cowboys and Indians is the perfect place to talk about him because you know what a Western icon the guy was. I think that's really the key to him, and the West, and the love of the West. Here are some highlights from our conversation with Dennis Quaid, edited for length and clarity. What would you say surprised you the most when you started researching Ronald Reagan's life? I found out that Reagan was a very humble man, actually, and not a rich man. We shot at the Reagan Ranch, which is not open to the public, went up there and got up on top of the mountain, which was the Western White House, basically, where he hosted Gorbachev and Queen Elizabeth. First off, it's about a 5-mile ride on probably the worst road in California to get up to it. Then you get up there and you see it all, and it's beautiful. You can really feel what a humble man he was. In what ways? Well, he bought the place right after he was governor of California, and they've kept it pretty much the way he and Nancy had it. They had GE appliances because he was a spokesman for GE. The house itself is about 1,200, 1,500 square feet. Not very big at all. They had what looked like a king-size bed, but it was two single beds that were zipped together to make a king-size bed. They had one of those old remote channel changers that go prong when you hit it. Their clothes were still in the closet as if they'd just left and were coming back. You could feel them up there. Reagan did all the work on the property as far as building all those fences and the pond that's there. You could feel him and all that and his love for that place. What do you think was the greatest challenge you faced while playing Reagan? Well, there's the voice. You're playing somebody that pretty much everybody in the world knows, how they walk, how they talk. To play him, well, I didn't want to play him as a hero, even though he was one. I wanted to play the human being. Nobody thinks of themselves as a hero. I wanted to get down to the human being to show what made him tick. He was a man who didn't show his private side all that much. I think in some ways he may have been a mystery to himself. It's become very common over the years for many people, even people close to him, personally and politically, to describe Reagan's acting career as undistinguished at best, vaguely embarrassing at worst. But really, he certainly was no worse and quite often much better than many of the notables routinely embraced as beloved old Hollywood contract players. And if he hadn't made the move into politics when he ran for governor of California, and if he had wanted to, he probably could have settled into a lengthy career as a character actor. Oh, yeah, he definitely would have done that, because he had to pay bills, and that would have been the way to do it. I don't think he was a bad actor. I think he was an unfulfilled actor with an unfulfilled career. John Wayne, that's the career he should have had. In fact, the two of them are very similar as being icons. I don't think he ever really truly got a chance at Warner Brothers to be an actor. He was going to do The Treasure of Sierra Madre, and they gave that to Bogie. I think that disappointed him. I don't think he felt success as an actor. He was very good in Westerns.
He was great in Westerns, yeah. Like I said, that's the career I think he should have had. He was an incredible horseman. Do you have a favorite Reagan movie performance? King's Row, the one where he loses his legs. Yeah, that's probably my favorite movie of his. But my favorite performance of his was President of the United States. That's where he showed his great acting skills, dealing with the Soviets the way he did. A lot of that was he made them think we had Star Wars right around the corner. That went a long way toward bringing them to the table and ending the Cold War, or at least the Cold War as it was back then. He even said that himself, that he was playing the role of the President of the United States and everything that went with it. Of course, becoming President of the United States was a good movie career. Yeah, no kidding. Does that inspire you at all? No, not one little bit. Not one little bit. You lose half of your audience as soon as you get elected. Now, this isn't your first rodeo in terms of playing presidents. You got some excellent reviews for your portrayal of Bill Clinton in The Special Relationship about Clinton's association with British Prime Minister Tony Blair. Was that more difficult or easier than playing Reagan? I think that was easier. For one thing, I knew Clinton and spent some time with him, actually, so that was a little bit easier. Clinton is much more approachable in that he really gives you a lot. I think Reagan was a lot more complicated than people think. He had his public persona, but then he had a very private persona as well. I wonder if he was aware of that. But he was a great communicator, an incredible communicator. You've looked pretty comfortable on horseback whenever a role has called for it. Do you still get to ride much in real life? No, I haven't. The only time I rode was about 3 months ago. In fact, we were just talking about it the other day because this is horse country here in Nashville. We'll go outside, and it's a great place to ride, in fact. Lots of different types of horses here, too. I guess I've owned horses for 30 years of my life, but I'm currently without. I used to have one right at my house here in L.A. by Will Rogers State Historic Park. You always feel better getting off a horse than you did getting on it, that's for sure. and I just love their beings and their personalities and their little quirks. It's quite an invested relationship with the horse. It's kind of like having a dog, but there are such a big challenge. They're bigger babies than dogs. But then again, a dog would never let you put a saddle on him and ride him, right? No, but a dog's a predator. A horse is prey, and that's the way they act. Everything looks bigger to them. I remember riding my horse into Will Rogers State Park, and they'd somebody have a sleeping bag over there. They'd want to run home because of the sleeping bag. You've got to feel their fear and catch it before they lose their mind. Feel the hair coming up on their back. That's what I love about when you have a horse. Rather than just riding a horse, you really have to get to know them and know what's coming before they do. At least that's the idea. Can we hope to see another Western sometime in your future? Oh, I'd love to do that, anytime. I'm always looking for that. But it's all about the story. You've always been active in music, especially after you played Jerry Lee Lewis in Great Balls of Fire. And you've toured extensively with your band, The Sharks. But you only recently recorded your first solo album, a gospel album? Yeah, I just finished my part of it yesterday. It's going into mixing, and it'll be out in October. It's just me and some guys who've been in Johnny Cash's band, half songs that I wrote and half songs that I grew up in the Baptist church with. You've dodged some curveballs and survived some hard knocks in your life, ranging from health issues and substance abuse problems to that terrible incident in 2007 when your twin infants were inadvertently given a life-threatening overdose of heparin. But your twins survived and you're still here. Do you ever feel like you've been blessed? I felt like that. I've been very lucky. Like there'll be the name on my autobiography, My Lucky Life. Because, you know, for one thing, I am still here, and nobody gets out of life unscathed, that's for sure. I even appreciate the bad experiences I've had, because I've learned a lot. McLeod, Manhattan Cowboy. New Mexico Marshal Sam McLeod taught the NYPD how to round up the bad guys. By David Hofstede. East versus West, city versus country. The number of films and TV shows developed out of that culture clash contrast could fill a cable network. Cliché it may be, but when these stories are done right, they usually work. Perhaps the most successful example from television is McLeod, 1970 to 1977, popularized as one of the rotating features in the NBC mystery movie. Dennis Weaver, as Marshal Sam McLeod, travels from Taos, New Mexico to New York to learn how police track down bad guys in the big city. When he shows up at the precinct with his cowboy hat and boots, sheepskin coat and bolo tie, he draws incredulous stares from the hard-boiled Manhattan cops. It's not long before someone calls him Tex. But amusement turns to resentment when McLeod disobeys orders and tracks down his own leads, using what Chief of Detectives Peter Clifford, J.D. Cannon, dismisses as one of the Marshal's barnyard theories, and solves the case. He was what I'd been waiting for, Weaver said of the character in an interview with the Television Academy Foundation. It was absolutely perfect for me. To many TV fans, Weaver had already found a perfect role as Matt Dillon's loyal, coffee-brewing deputy, Chester Good, on Gunsmoke. But after 9 seasons of limping around Dodge City, he was apparently ready for a new challenge. He played the title role of a California veterinarian in the short-lived series Kentucky Jones in 1964, and then co-starred with a black bear on Gentle Ben, 1967-69, which was canceled after 2 seasons. It was a blessing for me because if it had gone on, I probably wouldn't have gotten McLeod, Weaver recalled. The character was based on Arizona Deputy Sheriff Coogan, created by Herman Miller for the 1968 film Coogan's Bluff. The movie was the first collaboration between director Don Siegel and actor Clint Eastwood, whose grim, driven portrayal of Coogan was something of a test run for their next collaboration, Dirty Harry. Miller is credited as series creator on McCloud, and Weaver smoothed out Coogan's rough edges, making the Marshal more palatable for network television. He was a guy that had great compassion for the underdog. He believed in justice. If he saw a way of solving a problem, he didn't go by the book, which irritated the chief to no end, Weaver said. J.D. Cannon's portrayal of Chief Clifford alternated between begrudging respect for his maverick trainee, send in the sagebrush Sherlock Holmes, to barely restrained fury. After the Marshal ignores yet another directive, Clifford's exasperated cries of "McCloud!" were so habitual they became a running gag on Mystery Science Theater 3000. But the New York media embraced the laconic outsider, praising him after a successful closed case as a straight shooter in a place where everyone else has an agenda. Some of that favorable press comes courtesy of newspaper writer Chris Coughlin, played by Diana Muldaur. Though Coughlin appears in 15 episodes as McCloud's girlfriend, and Marshall's old-school Western charm makes him something of a ladies' man, which was probably welcome for Dennis Weaver after nearly a decade as unlucky in love Chester on Gunsmoke. Weaver received Emmy nominations in 1974 and 1975 for Outstanding Lead Actor in a Limited Series, and McCloud was a hit straight through to the last of its 46 episodes. In 1989, he reprised the role in The Return of Sam McCloud, in which his character was now a United States Senator. He probably didn't get Chief Clifford's vote. 5 memorable McClouds. Horse Stealing on Fifth Avenue, 1970. This first season installment contains the series' signature shot, McCloud riding a horse through the streets of New York. The scene was a last-minute addition to a script that originally just had the Marshal borrowing a policeman's horse and chasing a suspect through Central Park. That's why the production didn't have a permit from the city to shoot the scene, which was achieved by mounting a camera in the back of a station wagon and filming Weaver as he rode through Midtown Manhattan. Of course, jaded New Yorkers ignored him completely. Encounter with Ares, 1971. The title alludes to a tattoo of a ram's head on an arm of a kidnapper in this episode about a famed astrologer's wealthy wife, Louise Latham, being abducted. She's locked in a room with a time bomb that will detonate unless the ransom is paid in time, and McCloud is trying to beat the clock. A standard kidnapping story takes a mid-episode twist that surprises McCloud as much as the audience. The New Mexican Connection, 1972. During a stakeout, McCloud recognizes a man wanted for bank robbery back in his old jurisdiction of Taos. He transports him back to New Mexico, but that's far from the end of the story. The script, by series executive producer Glenn Larson, won an Edgar Award for the Mystery Writers of America, perhaps just for the audacity of a climactic chase in which McCloud, back in New York, fights one of the villains on top of a moving stagecoach. The Colorado Cattle Caper, 1974. One of the delights of the series is McCloud's clash with assorted city dwellers, but this episode offers a welcome break from that formula. After a tainted beef shipment causes fatalities in New York restaurants, the Marshal traces the shipment back to a gang of cattle rustlers in Colorado. The story features 2 1970s icons, singer John Denver as a deputy sheriff and Farrah Fawcett as a woman hired by the rustlers to distract the lawmen from their mission. This Must Be the Alamo, 1974. This was the first of four Alamo stories, two with Alamo in the title, in which the police station finds itself under siege, this time from mobsters trying to steal evidence of a bookmaking operation. Among the highlights are Terry Garr's delightful portrayal of Sergeant Phyllis Norton, and the first appearance of Dennis Weaver's son Robbie, who would also show up in future episodes. The Handcrafted Home on the Range. Handmade pieces create a welcoming atmosphere and help a Western home tell a story. By Elise Pierce. No matter what Western vibe you're aiming for, Colorado Mountain Cabin a la Ralph Lauren, Southwestern Adobe Chic, or Refined Ranch Rustic, one of the secrets to really making your decor come alive lies in handmade pieces. We talked with Jeremiah Young, the creative director and principal of the interior design firm Kibler & Kirch in Billings, Montana, about how handmade elevates the ambience of a Western home. And we explored the handcrafted appeal of a Wyoming ranch that remains Young's favorite project. C&I, you're a big fan of using handcrafted items in the client homes you design. Why do you rely on handmade over mass-produced, and how important is that in creating the ambience that you're after? Jeremiah Young, it's crucial. Over and above the function of a space is to be satisfying to the human condition, and there's no better way to give a place some soul than to gather up, procure, and place some handmade things in a house. There's a project I did not long ago where everything, down to every screw, was handmade. There are all these small moments that don't always come to the level of consciousness, but all of these small things add up to giving a lot of soul to a space. I think there's no greater thing than to say something was made by human hands. There's a big difference between something that's machined and handmade and things touched by human hands. Tell us more about how handmade pieces give a space soul. It's a sense of history, a sense of place, a sense of quality that's been vetted out over time. So the solution that was found for this door, this piece hardware, or maybe it's even a vase or a footstool, this is a solution that somewhere down the line there was a tradition developed of how to do it and how it was constructed. Because machines are relatively new in our history, there's a collective soul of objects and tradition, the way things are constructed. Most of the time, the old ways are best. How do you go about choosing handcrafted pieces for your projects? What do you look for? Well, you try to use materials that get translated into objects, wood or stone or metal or bronze. If you select things that get better over time, through use and through us touching them and using them, they look better and become better with age. The objective with handmade things is to have them look their best when they're quite old. What are your personal favorites when it comes to handmade elements in a room? Things made of leather, original art, the ultimate handmade thing, and case goods, wooden furniture. There's no machine that can make a curved, bow-front English dresser. It has to be done by hand. Where do you stand on mixing contemporary elements with homemade Western ones? It's sometimes really nice to contrast the two. A coffee table with a glass top, and on top is an old bowl that's been used and has gouges and nicks and darkness around the rim because humans have touched it and used it. Handmade elements can be mundane objects made of wood, elevated to a piece of art. Besides being pleasurable for the eye, how can handmade things help to tell our own personal history? All of the objects have a story, whether it's that object and who used it and how, or the story about why that object even exists. This ladder-back chair, this particular style. Then you take it a step further. As designers, we're telling that story too. Our interiors, the whole of them, are telling stories of place and material and the tradition that you're working on. What are some handmade pieces that you rely on again and again for your projects? A tooled ottoman, a leather-framed mirror, a great leather bag of some kind. Our recipe is to have a sofa in fabric because we find that to be more comfortable, and pairs of leather chairs. I'll take a great leather chair over a leather sofa any day. New World Trading makes some great hand-tooled leather ottomans. We've placed more of these in homes than I can count. House of Mercier from Peru is my go-to for leather frames, which we've used to make so many pieces of art sing. They are a great resource for mirrors as well. It's hard to beat Hancock and Moore and Hickory Chair for leather chairs, but my favorite styles are from smaller family-run companies like Classic Leather and McKinley Leather. I call on them to do custom things that the bigger companies just won't do. Of course, I like the Molesworth-style chairs, and Tim Lozier of Howcola Furniture can make anything we can dream up in that genre. You said you'd take a leather chair over a leather sofa, but I happen to know you have a fondness for a good Chesterfield. Oh, that's true. There's a Chesterfield from McKinley Leather I particularly like. Tufts like that, among other things, can only be done by hand. It's such a handsome piece, and we love using things like that in our interiors. What do all of the handcrafted pieces you've drawn have in common? I can close my eyes and visualize it. It's the quality of an old saddle that's been used, that's burnished with marks on it, and it's been oiled and cared for over time. That same quality could show up in a table or in a chair or a lamp or in the handle of your favorite handbag or satchel. Things that are well used but beautifully cared for. Things that are warm and welcoming. How would you describe your style and approach to design? I revel in the challenge of pulling out from my clients what's really satisfying to them. Sometimes that leads to a rustic path, and sometimes it's a contemporary path. But one thing we always have is an interesting mix of old and new and an interesting mix of styles. My favorite pieces of furniture are ones that I return to over and over again. You can't exactly pin down what that style is. It's that chair, if it's that chair that's a little art deco or Western or contemporary, but ends up fitting in a different interior. So in terms of what my style is, it's the art of the mix, the challenge of the mix. What's the key to finding the right handmade item for your home? Find the things that you're not afraid to touch or interact with. You know that chair has been sat in 1,000 times. You don't worry about sitting in that chair. It's the thing you get in the West that you don't get in the East or South, that casualness of things. I grew up in Tennessee, but my family would buy the highest quality they could afford and really take care of it. Everything was immaculately clean. You didn't go into the living room but once a year, and it was perfectly preserved. It's not like that in the West. We use our rooms, and we may not even fluff that cushion. Tell us about the Bighorn Ranch project in Wyoming. The whole thing, from that fabulous front porch to the interior walls, doors, cabinets, hardware, and furnishings, has that welcoming handcrafted feel. How did you achieve that vision? This project is my favorite place I've had the chance to work on through the years. In part, it's because of the homeowner, who has amazing taste and was patient enough to let us find the perfect things, but especially because it has such soul. It's unpretentious and unassuming in many ways, but everywhere you look, there's something made with care and touched by human hands. Down to the smallest detail, that home is thoughtful and uncompromising. What it lacks in size, it makes up for in real quality. There are Molesworth pieces by Mark Taggart, beadwork, hand-painted lightning, some of my favorite pieces by Classic Leather and McKinley Leather, a great collection of art that's ever-growing, and 100% handmade hardware on every drawer, door, window, cabinet, etc. It's a feast of things made by hand in traditional ways. It looks like Old Hickory, that wonderful Indiana company that's been around since 1899, plays a big role in that house. Yes, lots of Old Hickory. The house has the best rustic porch imaginable. It's a mellow mood, very comfortable with rocking chairs that you find in national park lodges from the turn of last century. Time seems to stand still there as you look at the Bighorn Mountains across the valley. I'm not sure if you know this, but I spent from 2018 to 2020 moonlighting as creative director for Old Hickory. I put together their showrooms and trade show booths and won a few awards competing against companies with big creative teams and really deep pockets. And I did that by using the most authentic approach I could and creating new pieces that took huge inspiration from Old Hickory's incredible archive. To date, there are about 30 pieces in their line that I designed, including the wood-burst mirror, which can only be made by carefully choosing the perfect pieces of wood and artfully assembling it by hand. I love that old American company and hope I can contribute to the next 100 years. I can attest that it's the most handmade furniture you can imagine. Besides that fantastic porch, what's your favorite space at Bighorn Ranch, and what does handmade have to do with it? As much as I love that porch, I also love the reading chairs in the master bedroom that sit near an amazing vignette of a blue painted cabinet below a great painting we took inspiration from. That was actually a really mundane cabinet I reimagined with paint, leather, and nail heads. What are you working on now that has exciting possibilities for incorporating handcrafted goods? I have two once-in-a-lifetime projects at the same time, one in Idaho looking at the Tetons and another in Telluride that sits at 10,000 feet elevation. In both of these projects, which will take years, as good projects always do, we are imagining interiors that incorporate the best of the best artisans of the West, people like metalsmith Glenn Gilmore and leather sculptor Christina Chapman. We're up to our elbows in figuring out how to collect the most impeccable handmade things, which, of course, means using the best paintings and sculpture as well. If you had to choose one handmade piece in a room, what would it be? Art? I'd sit alone in an empty room if there was a piece of art in it. And if money were no object, it would be a Charlie Russell painting. Come with us to the great state of South Dakota and the legendary state of North Dakota and find out why the natural division might be more east and west. By Lance Nixon. Homesteaders study me whenever I sit down at my desk, but I've never known for sure about the gray faces in that old family photograph. Is that some of my mother's Norwegian family who homesteaded in the Red River Valley of what would become North Dakota? Or are they some of my father's Finnish family, who homesteaded a few years later and a few miles west in the James River Valley in what would become South Dakota? The question has always seemed irrelevant to me because the life they lived was similar, and the things they faced and the stories they told about this place in Norwegian, in Finnish, in limping English, were pretty much the same. I grew up between two border towns. We went to school on the South Dakota side. We went to church and bought tractor parts on the North Dakota side. There wasn't a lot of difference. For the big secret about the Dakotas, as many residents will tell you, is that they have more in common north and south than they do east and west. I grew up hearing my father say Dakota should have been one state, or if they were determined to cut it in half, an East Dakota versus West Dakota split would have made more sense in 1889. It's simple geography. The Dakotas are spliced down the middle by the 100th meridian, which roughly approximates where the Missouri River bisects the states, says John Locke, a historian who works for South Dakota Senator John Thune. East of the line, the Dakotas have a Midwestern/Iowa-type orientation, and west of the line, the Dakotas tend to be Wyoming-ish. You can see it in the land and the crops and the people. Especially in South Dakota, which is entirely cut in half by the river. People in the Dakotas use the terms East River and West River to refer to those distinctly different regions and identities. The deep cultural differences make for countless jibes back and forth. One story, quite likely true, has it that the great Casey Tibbs, already famous as the greatest bronc rider in history, was greeted in a bar in Fort Pierre, Casey's hometown, by someone who seemed to know him. Casey, a West River cowboy from the rugged Mission Ridge country, was happy to visit, even though the conversation took place in the bathroom of the bar. After the stranger left, one of Casey's real acquaintances asked him, "Who was that?" Casey said, "I have no idea. He was from East River, though." "How do you know that?" "He washed his hands." South Dakota-grown Tony Bender, a columnist for 30 years for newspapers in both Dakotas, Minnesota and Montana, agrees that the North-South differences are harder to find. "The biggest differences are marked by the divide of the Missouri River," says Bender, who lives in North Dakota. "To the east, it's agrarian with plenty of cattle. West River, especially in North Dakota, is a different world. It's authentic cowboy country, less hospitable to grain farming and heavier on cattle, more driven by a cowboy culture than ethnicity. In the east, you find strong German and Scandinavian roots and culture. You can still hear German spoken in the small-town cafes, especially if they're talking about a stranger in town. That's waned, though, in recent decades." North or south of the line, we all honored people like Casey Tibbs. He's the main attraction at the Casey Tibbs South Dakota Rodeo Center in Fort Pierre. We had the same heroes in both Dakotas and the same outlaws, like the North Dakota-born wolf Old Three Toes, who preyed on sheep and cattle in both Dakotas from 1912 until 1925, when a government trapper finally caught him near Buffalo, South Dakota. As for our heroes, we tend to carve them into mountain faces. Mount Rushmore was the division of Doan Robinson, the aging state historian of South Dakota. To realize his dream of a mountain memorial so massive it would put the state on the map, he contacted sculptor Gutzon Borglum for his artistic prowess and gained the support of Senator Pete Norbeck for his political clout. Robinson originally imagined memorializing Western figures such as Chief Red Cloud, Buffalo Bill Cody, Lewis and Clark, and legendary Sioux warriors like Crazy Horse. But Gutzon decided on four U.S. presidents. South Dakota has a particular fondness for honoring U.S. presidents. Rapid City puts statues of the presidents along streets throughout its downtown and calls itself the City of Presidents. Perhaps we have a special debt to Thomas Jefferson for arranging the Louisiana Purchase, which included the western lands that would become the Dakotas and other states. but the most fitting of the four Borglum chose would have to be Theodore Roosevelt. More than any other president, Roosevelt belongs to the West. He was a rancher near what is now the North Dakota town of Medora, and he was emphatic about how crucial the experience there was in putting the finish on his character. Bigger than life, Roosevelt the rancher, Roosevelt the Rough Rider, is a key figure in North Dakota's tourism campaign to brand the state legendary. As Doug Ellison of Western Edge Brooks in Medora told me, Roosevelt consistently referred to his ranching days as pivotal and said several times that he would never have become president but for that experience. "Here the romance of my life began," Roosevelt said when he visited Medora on September 16, 1900, stumping for the McKinley-Roosevelt ticket. "I've studied a lot about men and things before I saw you fellows, but it was only when I came out here that I began to know anything or to measure men right. When I was a teenager, I remember musing about which presidents were memorialized on Mount Rushmore and puzzling over Theodore Roosevelt. Did he really belong there on the side of that mountain? My father, a farmer, who read history all winter when he couldn't be in the field, told me Roosevelt might be the president who most belongs up there, because he had lived out west and he had done so much for conservation and national parks. He had established our own Wind Cave National Park in South Dakota, for example. There's a project in the works to build the Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library in the rugged North Dakota landscape he loved, and its backers say their intent is to show what we can learn from, not about, our 26th president. What makes the project brilliant is the location. Only in southwestern North Dakota will people be able to learn something vital about Theodore Roosevelt, because it's not in the history books. It's in the land. However important those presidents are in American history, memorializing white men and the Black Hills called for an indigenous answer. In the late 1930s, Chief Henry Standing Bear of the Lakota wrote to sculptor Korzak Zakowski, who had once been chosen by Borglum to work with him on the carving of Mount Rushmore. "My fellow chiefs and I would like the white man to know the red man has great heroes too," the chief explained, and Zakowski began to work on an idea for a counterpart, Crazy Horse. When the sculptor died in 1982, his wife took over, and on her death in 2014, family members carried on. When the memorial is ultimately completed, the Black Hills-born Oglala Lakota warrior will appear to charge right out of the mountain, his likeness based solely on descriptions because he refused to have his picture taken. According to the Crazy Horse Memorial Foundation, the great carving is meant to honor all the indigenous people of North America. Crazy Horse will be riding his steed out of the granite of the sacred Black Hills with his left hand gesturing forward in response to the derisive question asked by a cavalryman, "Where are your lands now?" Crazy Horse replied, "My lands are where my dead lie buried." The focal point of a large university campus and cultural complex celebrating the Native Americans of North America, the memorial immortalizing Crazy Horse is so massive it could contain all four heads of Mount Rushmore. Like much of the history and culture of the Dakotas, these statements in stone transcend state lines and borders and speak to the West and to the nation.
Hello, this is Michael. I'm reading the final two articles from True West Magazine's July-August 2022 edition. The Tale of the Empty Chamber by Bob Bozbell. Billy the Kid versus Joe Grant, an eyewitness revelation. January 10th, 1880. Bob Hargrove's saloon in the old Fort Sumner, New Mexico, is packed with cowboys, including James Chisholm, brother of John, and three of his cowhands. Chisholm and his men have been invited to take a drink with Billy the Kid, who enters the saloon with them. Joe Grant, a newcomer to the area, notices the cowboys entering and snatches an ivory-handled pistol from Jack Finnan's holster, while at the same time putting his own pistol in the cowboy's holster. The kid steps up to him and says, "That's a beauty, Joe." The kid takes the pistol from Grant's hand and spins the cylinder, checking at the same time to see how much ammunition it contains. 3 cartridges. He purposely moves the cylinder so the next load will be a failure. Then he returns the revolver to Grant. "Pard," says Grant, as he sneers at the kid, "I'll kill a man quicker than you will for the whiskey." "What do you want to kill anybody for?" asks the kid, flashing his winning smile. "Put up your pistol and let's drink." Grant moves behind the bar and starts viciously knocking about glasses and decanters with his pistol. "Let me help you break up your housekeeping, pard," says the kid, drawing his own pistol and joining in the glass breaking. Grant suddenly stops and eyes James Chisholm. "I want to kill John Chisholm anyhow, the damned old—" "You've got the wrong pig by the ear, Joe," says the kid. "That's not John Chisholm." "That's a lie," shouts Grant. "I know better." And with that, he turns, points his pistol at the kid, and pulls the trigger. Instead of an explosion, the gun clicks loudly. Cussing, Grant raises the hammer for another shot, but before he can thumb it, a ball from the kid's revolver crashes through his brains. He collapses behind the counter. Emptying his spent shell, the kid remarks, "Unfortunate fool, I've been there too often to let a fellow of your caliber overhaul my baggage. Wonder if he's a specimen of Texas desperados." A bystander wonders aloud whether Grant has been killed and warns the kid to watch out. Billy smiles and says, "No fear, the corpse is there, sure, ready for the undertaker." While being held at the jail in Las Vegas, the kid is brought outside so the crowds can gawk at the captured celebrity. Perhaps as amazed as anyone, Billy later remarks to a reporter, "There was a big crowd gazing at me, wasn't there?" Aftermath odds and ends. Some scholars debate whether the Grant fight actually took place. Passed down by Jim Chisholm's son, the details of the shooting became part of the folklore around Fort Sumner, and the facts in the case are mighty slim. Still, the fight has the ring of truth to many Billy scholars and is generally accepted as being a bona fide event because the Chisholms are a trustworthy source. Also, a Las Vegas Daily Gazette newspaper quote from Billy helps to substantiate the shooting. Billy the Kid continued rustling cattle, mostly Chisholms, in the Fort Sumner area, and also demanded $500 from John Chisholm for services rendered to the Tunstall McSween cause during the late Lincoln County War. John declined to pay, and Billy vowed he would steal from your cattle until I get it. A new book by James B. Mills makes a good point. Strangely, Paco Anaya's first-hand recollection of the shooting in Anaya's "I Buried Billy," pages 77 to 81, has been routinely disregarded in favor of these second-hand Anglo accounts, although he recalled the time frame incorrectly by a couple of months, November 1879. Unlike both Will Chisholm and Charlie Four, Paco Anaya was both physically present in the saloon and an actual resident in the Fort Sumner region at the time of the shooting. Hence, his vivid recollection of the saloon fight should rightly take precedence, which is why I have used it as my primary source. Paco Anaya was there. Will Chisholm, Charlie Four, Pat Garrett, and Ash Upson were not. Recommended, Billy the Kid, El Bandito Simpatico, University of North Texas Press, $34.95, by James B. Mills. Cowboys, Shotguns, and Hackamores, by Marshall Trimble. Question: where did cowboys like John Ringo and Curly Bill Brosius live? Walt Serafin, Shawnee, Kansas. They spent much of their time in Galeyville, Arizona territory, an outlaw-friendly town in the north end of the Chiricahua Mountains. They both were mobile, spending time in Tombstone, Charleston, and at ranches that were friendly to cowboys. Question. I've been watching the TV show 1883. Why would immigrants who landed in Texas travel to Oregon in wagons? Elmer Groton, San Antonio, Texas. It's historical fiction, one that I believe will be a Western classic. Some of the characters, like General George Meade, Tom Hanks, and Jim Courtwright, Billy Bob Thornton, are real people. There was a large German immigration to Texas through the port of Galveston. The costuming is authentic. The characters look like they've really been exposed to the elements. It would be easy to believe this is based on a true story of the westward expansion, but most has been created by Taylor Sheridan. Unlike the show, by 1883, the Comanche people were all living on a reservation in Oklahoma. There were settlements all along the way. Also, by that time, there were several transcontinental railroads crossing the West. If the wagon train was bound for Oregon, they would have reached the Oregon Trail in Nebraska or eastern Wyoming and headed west toward Fort Hall. Montana was a huge detour that practically nobody made unless they decided to follow the Bozeman Trail north and forego traveling west on the Oregon-California Trail. Question. What is sarsaparilla? John Sparks, Reno, Nevada. It was a soft drink made from wild sarsaparilla, a North American member of the ginseng family. It was called the father of root beer. The predominant root beer flavoring used to be a sassafras root. I say used to be, at least in the U.S., because it contains safroli, believed to be a carcinogen. Question. How did horses survive the brutally cold temperatures in the Rocky Mountains? Mike Stanton, Hamilton, Montana. Horses can handle cold weather much better than humans. Their winter coats are longer and their hair is coarser. That serves as insulation by reducing the loss of body heat. In the open, a horse will be okay down to 18 degrees, but with some kind of shelter or windbreak, they can handle temperatures as low as minus 40 degrees. Question. Were there any female shotgun messengers? David Fuller, Lisbon, Connecticut. John Bossenecker, author of Shotguns and Messengers, The Brave Men Who Rode for Wells Fargo and the Wild West, says, there were definitely no female shotgun messengers, and most of the stuff written about Charlie Parkhurst are tall tales. She was, in fact, a hostler and may have driven stages in the Santa Clara, California coastal area, but she was never robbed and had no adventures that were mentioned in the 19th century newspapers. Also note that Mary Fields did drive a stage in Montana, but there is not a single mention of anyone called Stagecoach Mary in pre-1900 newspapers. Question. In the movie Tom Horn, Steve McQueen can be seen riding a horse using a hackamore instead of a traditional bitted bridle. How common was that? Spencer Ward, Gaithersburg, Maryland. A hackamore is traditionally used in the progression of a horse's training. Some riders prefer using one instead of a traditional bridle. It doesn't have a bit, but has a noseband that works on pressure points on the face. There is a common misconception that bitless bridles are kinder than those with a bit. However, horses have many sensitive nerve endings in their faces, and the hackamore applies pressure to them. As a result, the severity of it depends on the hands of the rider, similar to a traditional bit. The word hackamore is derived from the Spanish word jaquima, meaning headstall or halter. It is most closely affiliated with the vaquero tradition of horse training and most commonly seen today in Western riding for starting young horses. Question: how did cowboys working in the heat of summer stay cool in their hats? Neil Hathaway, Durango, Colorado. They didn't. Straw hats were much cooler. However, most cowboys stubbornly refused to wear those hats, no matter how hot it got, as a substitute for their Stetsons. Many did wear lighter colored hats, so that wouldn't hold the heat as much as the black ones. Question: were cowboys superstitious? Bill Dunn, High River, Alberta, Canada. Rodeo cowboys believed in dozens of superstitions. Some of them include: never eat chicken before rodeo because you are what you eat. Never wear yellow in the arena because the color is associated with cowardice. Never set a cowboy hat on a bed because, for some reason, that could lead to a major injury or death. The long sleep. To clean yourself up for lady luck, always shave before a performance. Question: why were some of the shotguns called greeners by cowboys in the Old West? Jack A. Graves, Turlock, California. The term greener comes from a family of popular weapon makers. Founded by William Greener in 1829 in England, the company has been producing fine shotguns and rifles for five generations. Greener was the author of three of the most influential books written on the subject of shooting: The Gun, 1835, The Science of Gunnery, 1842, and Gunnery in 1858. His son, also named William, wrote the classic Gun and Its Development. Visit www.greener.com to learn more about the company and its guns. Question: did cowboy use gloves in their work? Ralph D. Hart, Centerville, Texas. Leather gloves were an essential part of a cowboy's attire. These protected the hands from rope burns, blisters, brush, and hot branding irons. They also wore leather cuffs. These protected his wrists from rope burns and kept his lower shirt sleeves from wear and tear. Question: of all the TV westerns from the 1950s and 60s, which was the most authentic in terms of scenery, clothing, and dialogue? Bob Powers, Cincinnati, Ohio. I missed some of the earlier ones since we didn't have a TV. I don't think any of them wins a prize for authentic clothing or set design. They didn't look like they'd spent much time outdoors. All that being said, I believe the best television show for creative writing, content, and storyline is Gunsmoke, followed closely by Have Gun Will Travel. Question: when did the practice of horseshoeing begin, and what was the purpose of doing so? Pat McManus, Cave Junction, Oregon. Horseshoes date back to the demonstration of the animals in Asia a few thousand years ago. Around 800 BC, at the beginning of the Iron Age in Central Asia, people began riding horses rather than using them exclusively as beasts of burden. The purpose of horseshoes is to protect the hoof wall from chipping or cracking. An early form of hoof protection used by the Asians was rawhide or leather. The nailed shoe is believed to have been developed around 900 AD. Today, they are usually made of steel or aluminum, but specialized shoes include rubber or plastic. Question: what bacon did trail cowboys eat? Dave Macon, Shreveport, Louisiana. Bacon was a staple on trail rides and at line camps. The cowboys were actually eating sow belly. It was pork fat from the belly, and perhaps the back and sides, of a hog carcass cured with salt. Sow belly could last a long time without spoiling. Question: did Old West cowboys really wear bib shirts? Barbara Young, Little Rock, Arkansas. Bib shirts were popular military wear and worn by militias and firemen. but they never really caught on with cowboys. During the heyday of Westerns on television and movies, they were somewhat popular. Yep, John Wayne wore them in several films, including The Searchers, The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, and the John Ford Cavalry films. That inspired lesser knowns to imitate the Duke. But that was Hollywood, not real life.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.